The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Tech Weekly with me, Keith Stewart. And this week we'll be mostly staring into a giant robotic ball.
It's made of a high-density polycarbonate. It's about the size of a baseball, and it glows basically any color you want.
Connected toys are at the intersection between gaming and robotics, and Ian Bernstein, co-creator of the robotic gaming ball, the Sphero, thinks it's a fun intersection to be in right now. That's why we are dedicating the show to look at how the idea of video games is being changed by smartphones, sophisticated robotics, and some really creative uses of traditional game controllers. This is a kind of wacky, offbeat edition of the Tech Weekly podcast from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio today from The Guardian's tech desk is Alex. Sorry, I was just interjected for you, like a robot.
Alex Hearn.
Thank you. And I'm delighted to say that in the studio with us today are the director of the Game City Festival in Nottingham, Ian Simons. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Keith.
And the producer of the excellent LEGO games, Jonathan Smith. Hello.
Hello. Great pleasure to be here.
But first, we are going to hear from a really interesting and BAFTA award-winning indie games maker, Lucky Frame. As well as creating lovable smartphone and PC titles like Gentleman and Bad Hotel, this Edinburgh-based studio has experimented with more physical and social interactive projects, where the screen is only ever part of the experience. Co-founder of Lucky Frame, Jan Sesnick, joins me now from Edinburgh. Welcome to Tech Weekly, Jan.
Hey, how's it going, Keith?
It's good, good. How are you?
It's great to be here.
So you obviously make what I'll call, for the purposes of this, traditional games, i.e. games that we play on a screen with a controller. But you also have a kind of experimental approach to game design there at Lucky.
Yeah, I think we do. I mean, I think there's only three of us in the studio, and all three of us are artists originally. And so we kind of take that approach to everything we make.
And can you tell us about when I came up to Game City in October, you had a fantastic, amazing game there, which I'm probably going to describe as a sort of a wriggle simulator. It's called Ruffle Pillar. Could you tell us what Ruffle Pillar is and how it came out?
Well, it's just another in a long, great tradition of wriggle simulators. It's Ruffle Pillar is a two-player caterpillar simulator where you lie on the floor with a friend or a stranger, and you put your head in a box, and in the box there's a screen, and you wear some sort of belt sack attachment mechanism. We've experimented with a few different types. Which can tell where your hips are, so it's kind of tracking your hip movement. And there's a game where you play as a caterpillar against each other. It's two caterpillars on the screen in the box, and so you wriggle your whole body around to control your caterpillar.
And it's that's
it in a nutshell.
Watching people play this at Game City and other events since is just one of the most hilarious things you can possibly see. Like two people with their heads inside a box wriggling away on the floor. It's not kind of what you'd think of as video games, is it, for most people?
Yeah, it's funny. There's kind of two elements there that you just mentioned. Is that one of the elements is that when you have your head in a box, you really stop thinking about your body, which I think is a really wonderful thing. Like you become a bit like an ostrich with your head in the sand, and so it becomes a really great sort of spectator sport as well. So that, you know, the two people that have their heads in the box are completely unaware of all the people that are around them watching them, and it becomes this kind of great group activity. And it's funny because even when you have been one of the people in the audience watching somebody else play, you still totally forget about the rest of your body while you're playing, and you end up wriggling in a really funny way. I mean, I think it's, in terms of gameplay, it's just we're really interested in kind of in physical playing. I think it's about getting moving your body and really playing around with that as a game, as an input for gameplay.
Yeah. And I think another important part, which you mentioned with Ruffle Pillar, is this idea of spectatorship and socializing. And what we're seeing a lot of, you know, when people think of video games, they often think of them as something you do alone in front of a screen at home. And while obviously that is the sort of mainstream experience, what we're seeing is events like Wild Rumpus and events like the Game City Festival and lots of other events around the world, especially at big kind of games festivals like South by Southwest and GDC, are parties where people get together and play these experimental games together, and the games themselves kind of become a facilitator of like social interaction. They're not the focus, are they?
Yeah, and it's such a that's something that we've been really, really, really lucky to have been a part of recently. It's so exciting to see that kind of stuff happening with, like you say, Wild Rumpus and Game City are two things that we've managed to get our games into. And it's just so amazing because it's well, there's just such an amazing energy there because it's this, all these people who are, I mean, the organizers are always doing an amazing job as well, which helps. But even just the concept of just having people together in a kind of fun sort of way to play games and laugh about them and learn about them, but in a really fun sort of, yeah, a party atmosphere, it makes so much sense. And it's kind of amazing that that it's taken this long in a way. You know, like what is it about games that made people it's insular for so long? Why did it take this long? And it's just wonderful. I mean, we put an event together up here in Edinburgh called Tacos, Bluegrass, and Video Games, which featured video games and bluegrass and tacos, and it was amazing that the outpouring and support that there was for it, because so many people were just so ready for it, so ready for a kind of an event where you could have fun and play ridiculous games.
Can you tell us some of the games that you had at the Tacos, Bluegrass, and Video Games, which is easily the best combination I can imagine for a night out?
It was pretty. It was really amazing. We had beer as well, but we didn't put that in the title. We didn't want to put anyone off who didn't want to drink. Well, we had Raffelpiller, and we had our gentleman that we built into a suitcase. We called the Gentlecade. We also had Punch the Custard by George Buckingham, which is a Wild Rumpus favorite, or at least, anyway, George made it.
It's a game where you literally punch a bowl of custard, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's two of you. It should be Punch the Custards, really, I guess. We made a custom sort of sports table arena for Michael Bros' Smess Sport, which is a kind of abstract four-player sports game. So we made a table where we embedded the screen into it, and then we made a little stadium with moving fans that were cheering you on. But yeah, it was a pretty amazing collection of crazy abstract games. We tried to have we wanted no kind of violent games, no sexist games, yeah, just stuff that anybody could play.
This is an important point as well, because one of the things we're going to be talking about later in this podcast is the idea of games kind of merging with robotics. And there's lots of toys that are coming out, drone toys and also robots, which are iPhone controlled. This looks like it's going to be sort of a next big thing. And again, this is an idea of game design conventions moving out and away from the screen, and also, but also importantly, being more inclusive. So lots of these toys are designed to teach children about games and to teach children about coding. It just seems like there's something very interesting happening where, as soon as you take video game designers and creative people and almost like make the screen secondary, you get lots of more inclusive ideas, lots of ideas which embrace families and children as well as traditional gamers.
Yeah, screens are really not a great interface, are they? As soon as you have a screen, it really focuses your attention in a certain way and you have a certain set of expectations. And I'm really excited to see more and more non-screen based kind of physical games. I think it's an amazing world to get into.
And I think you're organizing another Bluegrass Tacos and Games event, aren't you? You organizing another one for?
Yeah, well, we've got big plans.
Okay, should people come to your website? Is it www.luckyframe.com?
Luckyframe.co.uk, and follow us on Twitter, Lucky_Frame. There's like an actual framing company that uses Lucky Frame in one word.
You don't want to confuse them by asking them for Raffelpiller.
Yeah, I suspect they're probably pretty confused on a daily basis.
Jan, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thanks a bunch, Keith. Say hello to everyone else there for me.
I will do. Bye bye.
All right, have a good one.
Ian, obviously you direct Game City, and a Game City last year, I mentioned about this, but you had a kind of a pop-up arcade there, which was a sort of an empty retail unit, which you kind of turned into this weird space full of interesting games like Ruffle Pillar. Can you tell us a bit some of the games there and the, and your sort of thoughts and philosophies about why you had that space?
Yeah, so we run a thing called the Open Arcade at the festival, which we have done since probably year three or four. And it's interesting what Jan was saying about the kind of tyranny of screens. And one of the things that from an event design, a festival design point of view, that we think about all the time when you're dealing with large amounts of people, it, you know, is obviously that spectatorial experience, which isn't necessarily something that games are primarily concerned with, you know, in the first instance. So what's going to be performed outside of the screen that other people can, you know, be entertained by or participate in. So we've played around with lots of different ways of doing that over the years. And when we launched Open Game City, which is basically an invitation to anyone with something interesting that they might want to come and do to do at the show, that tends to be expressed by both the Open Arcade as the epicenter of that, but also lots of other locations around the city. So somebody really wants to do something experimental in a, you know, swimming baths or a church or a public toilet. So, you know, one of those sort of spaces. We try and animate the city and put games in different places in that way. But the Open Arcade last year was, I think, the best version of that we've done. So what we've done previously was build a big tent over the Market Square right in the middle of the city. And that got us kind of so far. But the problem with tents is they don't have windows, unless they're very expensive tents. We can't afford to deal with those. It's greenhouses, really. So we did it in a big empty furniture store with a big glass frontier so people could see in. So there's lots and lots of space. It was about 4,000 square feet, I think. And there were some screens because, you know, it isn't necessarily about completely cancelling out screens, but allowing like a much greater amount of space for people to both kind of congregate around games, wander between them, and I guess sort of just kind of lounge around, and given the space really room to breathe, worked really, really well for us. So Ruffle Pillar was there, which was fantastic, and people would gather around it and watch it being played because it performs like this curiosity, if that's not a weak way of expressing it, but it was a fantastic performance of it.
I mean, Ruffle Pillar, one of the great things about being in the audience of it is you stand, you arrive, and you see these people lying in a box,
right,
just wriggling. And until you actually get to play it, you're never really sure what's happening or why. It really is a perfect spectator experience in that way. It stays baffling and obscure for so long. And
absolutely.
Then it all comes together when you actually put your head in the box. It's like, that's absolutely why they were squiggling.
It's just like a perfect event, you know, for a festival like ours. It's like this thing that it's like a secret in and amongst itself, you know, that you can only unlock it by actually putting your head in the box. But everybody seems fine when they come out of the box. You don't need to worry that it's, you know, full of spiders.
Jonathan, obviously one of the interesting ideas that we have about the social games we've talked about, but also what we're going to talk about, drone games and also remote control kind of robot games, is this idea of parents working together with children and discovering things with their children. And obviously with the Lego games, that's been a really important part for me. I taught my children to play games effectively through Lego, through Lego Indiana Jones 2. Is that something you always think about as designers? Not just the idea, well, this is a cooperative game, but this is a game that parents and children can share, and it's also bringing in this whole other outside world of Lego as a physical toy.
We always think about how people are going to play the games. That's certainly right. It's interesting. I was very, very struck by Jan asking the question, why haven't people played in these ways before? I think it's the case that for a long time, technology has been absolutely fascinating. And in a relatively short space of time, we've travelled an enormous distance from a technology point of view. If you think what you could do with a video game 20 years ago against what you could do with a video game now or 5 years ago, there's a massive direction of travel. That was very, very interesting. But now it's turned out that actually it's even more interesting to think about what people can do and what people can do together.
We've seen for a number of years the idea of like map editors in games. But I think now what we're seeing is people building their own content around games. Like, you know, Minecraft is an obvious example that people are making Let's Play videos and creating amazing worlds that are theirs, and they create narratives behind them. I think there is a sense now much more of games as social and imaginative facilitators rather than content we just consume.
Well, there's definitely a relationship there. So you are right. I think that is also about people turning out to be even more interesting than technology in terms of what they can bring to a games experience. In 2002, when we started work on Lego Star Wars, my son Sam, my middle son Sam, was born. And this year, as we release Lego Marvel, the video game, he is now of the generation where he's about to release his first game on the App Store. So the idea of children learning how to play games and then learning how to make games, I think, has been absolutely the direction of travel of the last decade. It's incredibly exciting, and they're bringing so many fresh ideas along with all those other content creators.
I think what's great about both kind of Rothelpiller and Crisis Panic Team, which was the game that Jonathan made, is how openly they betray how they're built. So Rothelpiller, you can see the pieces of string attached to a sleeping bag, and they're kind of trying, it kind of works. And Crisis Panic Team, you can see the pieces of 2x4 and the big switches that are made and how it was. And you can kind of, it invites you to understand not just like how to celebrate what it is and understand the kind of theatre of it, but also like literally, oh, there's pieces of wire that are going, you know, they're kind of going to the PC. And you feel like you could build it or extend it. And that's really important. It's that kind of spirit of, I don't know if you did this with your dad, but, you know, taking the back off the video recorder on the kitchen table when your kid's seeing how the thing works and seeing into the process of it. And it's not in some kind of sacred way of Capice's magic, but you can do it. You can absolutely do this. And that's such a positive thing to be able to say to anybody, let alone kind of young people.
Because 15 years ago, if you wanted to create video games, you were a teenager, you know, you'd be looking at PlayStation 1 titles for which you needed a proprietary development kit, you know, PCs, and it was all completely inaccessible. And sort of the idea of 3D modelling was something that was, you know, magical and alien and extraordinary. Whereas now a generation of players connected to Steam and the indie game scenes are getting exposed to, you know, games that run in all kinds of different resolutions that have been made by individuals, you know, part-time, in a week, in a day, in a game jam. And as Ian says, they become then the process to make the route to making those becomes much more accessible to all kinds of different people. And that definitely, again, contributes to the flourishing that we are currently seeing.
Yeah, and I think another important thing about Game City and the LEGO games, I think we've touched on already, is this idea of, there's this idea that there's certain types of games for children, hardcore games, and certain types of games for parents. Like, so your mum might play Candy Crush Saga, but she's not going to be, you know, interested in Grand Theft Auto or something like that. But I think fundamentally what we're seeing with lots of these games which don't have screens as a focus, so the games that Jan makes at Lucky Frame, and games like Johann Sebastian Joust, which is a game which uses the Move controllers without actually a screen, and you've got to try and group of eight people, and you've got to try and knock each other's Move PlayStation Move controllers so that they're effectively out, and whoever's controller is not last is the winner. Games like this, I think, kind of break down those barriers between generations, so that everybody can appreciate a robot which you can control with an iPhone. Everyone can appreciate Rothelpiller because it's kind of obvious and it's shareable in that way that, like, the very best family films, like Pixar films, are shareable in a really kind of like profound, meaningful way, rather than just, oh, it's a family film because it's a certificate U.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that's interesting that's happening, that games are becoming an actual real family idea through these social interactions.
And that's where cooperative play is again very, very useful. We have it in the LEGO games. Another game that Lucky Frame actually created an installation for at the Open Arcade for Game City last year, and a game which then subsequently, to my and many other people's extreme delight, won the Game City prize last year, was called Space Team. Space Team, a four-player cooperative game where the players are in command of different control panels on a spaceship and have to call to each other instructions in this baroque, hilarious science fiction language. And the interface, the actual pressing of buttons on your mobile phone or tablet, is immediately accessible, clear, and communicable to anyone who's ever used a mobile phone. Which isn't everybody, but it's a much greater number of people than are comfortable with using an Xbox One controller.
Yeah. Another thing we ought to very quickly bring into this is that, Alex, I know you've obviously been playing Hearthstone a lot recently, which is a kind of, it's essentially an iPad game, but it's a card fighting game.
It's an iPad card game. I mean, Space Team I find quite interesting because it's definitely at the borderline of what would be necessarily a video game versus a game. And Johann Sebastian Joust at the other end, you see you know, games sold in boxes, which aren't much different from Johann Sebastian Joust. It's just they don't use a PS4 or a PS3 to do it. They just have simple motion sensors in the little sticks that you're trying to knock out of each other's hands.
Or you just run around with spoons.
Exactly, right? Exactly. Hearthstone is going the opposite way. Hearthstone is just, it is a traditional card game on the iPad. That's both the best and worst thing about it. It's a wonderfully executed version of essentially Magic the Gathering. Like, Blizzard wears its influences on its sleeves. It's a Warcraft-themed version of Magic the Gathering. It has free-to-play mechanics like almost every iPad game out these days, but it executes them fairly in a way that you don't end up grinding. You can pay to win, but if you don't pay to win, you don't feel too under the heel of those who do. But the problem with it is it's in this sort of twilight state where it's neither video gamey enough. It neither is using the video gamey stuff to make it better for the card game fans, nor is it enough of an innovative, interesting card game that the video game fans are going to be won over.
No, yeah, but it kind of, I guess, like the other stuff we've talked about here, it represents this crossover between sort of traditional gaming idea concepts and video game technology. Like, lots of video games now are drawing very heavily on board games, and lots of game developers I know, if you go into a game development studio these days, you're as likely to see boxes full of tabletop games as you are boxes full of video games.
Yeah, I mean, the most interesting ones, traditional board card games are, I mean, they are video games stripped down to their barest essence. They are just mechanics and really not much else. And so what you end up with, Jonathan is looking bemused. You don't agree?
Well, I think the experience of playing board games comes with a lot more than just mechanics in terms of the social interactions, the story, crucially, that is created by the players as they play that game. When you play Monopoly, you're not just moving pieces around a board that's coloured in, following the instructions on cards to move pieces of paper around. You are narrating between yourselves a story of capitalist domination and exploitation and crisis and drama. I think it's the drama. I pulled a face at your description there, because I think you missed an acknowledgement of the drama that comes with board games as well.
Do you think that's maybe what... because it does seem to me that video game developers are more and more looking at board games and are looking at card games. And for me, I thought, oh, maybe they are. It is because the mechanics are so pure. But there's obviously stuff there they can learn from the social side, isn't there? Because game stories are usually pretty terrible and non-interactive.
Yeah, very, very definitely. But socially... is that the key? So stories is one thing. How you create an imaginative world amongst people that they can share with the minimum of sort of effort required by the audience, as well as like amount of stuff you have to make. Board games can conjure really smartly when people are together. They do a lot of the work for you. But then crucially, in terms of social roles, you're absolutely right. And with a lot of interesting board games now, again, there's a flourishing in this field too, where you talk about asymmetric roles in board games. So it's not necessarily everyone's on an equal footing in competition with each other, or everyone's on equal footing in cooperation with each other, but there are different and shifting roles and powers and alliances and capabilities. That's a really, really interesting area of development that has a lot of lessons that are still in the process of being described and articulated for video games.
Well, we're going to move on to talking about drones and robots in a minute. Once, a long time ago, I used to do a weekly column for the Guardian newspaper when we still had a technology section on Thursdays. And every week I had to come up with something else, and usually I wrote it the morning it was due in. And one week I wrote a piece about how I thought that the future of video games was actually going to be competitive robot battling in essentially a real geographic space. So instead of playing Doom or Call of Duty and fighting people on a screen, we'd all have our own drones or our own little robots, and they would go out into the street and we'd control them around until we found other people's robots and then fought them. Was I mad, Jonathan? Was that madness?
Well, have you just invented war?
Yeah.
thanks for that. Could you uninvent it?
I'm only 20,000 years too late. But yeah, but fun robot war.
So you've invented robot wars.
Have I just contravened everyone's human rights? I don't know, but I'm interested in this idea. I wonder, taking the idea of getting away from the screen but with game mechanics to its ridiculous conclusions, I wonder if there is... like at the moment, some of the basic toy drones we're seeing are very much single player, but I wonder if there is a future in in Robot Wars. Ian?
You say, should I say if this is or isn't the next big thing? Is
it? Yeah.
I can well imagine that once equipped with the ability to build sentient robots, the first thing that will happen is that we will make them fight. But then they'll learn to love. But I think I'm sure that there will be a period where that happens, Keith. Yes, I don't want to invest right now.
Okay,
if that's
I'm not going to force
that you're making.
Yeah, that is. I have actually turned this into a pitch. I have a robot company. It's either you guys are buying it or Google.
But it is quite interesting that, I mean, one of the reasons why we on the technology desk focus so much on games is games are often the first places to use new technology that no one can really actually see a non-play use for. There's a lot of stuff in the game's world which starts with someone making something that's a bit cool and kind of going, what can we do with this? Have fun, I guess. And even outside of games, you see a lot of toys. It's the same deal. Toys, Play-Doh, for instance, was invented by a materials researcher who simply couldn't find a use for this weird substance he discovered and started packing it up and selling it as a kid's toy. And I can see the same sort of thing happening to robots now. Drones, aerial drones, have quite a lot of, you know, very concerning uses, but also sticking a camera on a helicopter is changing journalism, changing photojournalism. Sticking guns on a helicopter is changing the face of warfare. But when it comes to what you can do with smaller, less impressive mechanically robots, I do think a lot of places are going, yeah, these are toys. And if they're toys, why can't you play games with them?
Yeah, so the really interesting thing about robots, I think, and I think the reason they're particularly interesting for kids, for children, is because they can expose the process of learning. They're an artificial life that you can control and create. So, and this comes back to some of the things we were saying a moment ago about, you know, particularly a new generation, but more generally, people now contributing creatively to the building of fun in games. And robots are the perfect avenue to that, because when you start with a robot, they don't do anything. They have to be programmed. They have to be built, first of all, and then they have to be programmed. And then they come alive because of what you did. Now, I think as a child, you're experimenting with that process at the same time as you are experimenting in your own life about learning and coming alive yourself. So I think it's a really, really powerful educational tool and a great experience for families to be able to have together. That's incredibly powerful.
Okay, well, we're going to move on to drones in a minute, so we'll just finish up here. Ian, there's going to be a Game City, I presume, this year?
There's going to be a Game City 9 from the 25th of October to the 1st of November. Over in Nottingham.
Will we be able to experience some of these social gaming phenomena that we've been speaking about there?
Absolutely. So, I mean, Game City it's all social, pretty much. So, yeah, there will be a box to put your head in at some point, I'm sure. But when you're outside of that, it will be completely social.
And do you think we're going to see more? I mean, I've mentioned Wild Rumpus, which happens like once every quarter. And there are a few more events like this that happen around Britain. Do you think we're going to see more of this? Do you think we're going to see social gaming taking off as a phenomenon?
I hope so. I mean, things like alternative uses of cinemas, things like alternative uses of different spaces around the country is something that's, you know, ways in which gaming can be not singled out as a kind of odd thing that's a niche that happens over here away from the rest of, you know, the rest of society and the rest of the things that we do for recreation is really interesting. So I think the more that gaming is normalized and it's embedded and it's just a thing that happens. I mean, we were talking earlier about Japan and however they're just the act of play is completely natural. The more that happens, I think, in the UK, the more people are given, you know, permission to play, as Jonathan would talk about, is fantastic. It's completely positive.
Ian and Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. They've been lurking in the background for a while, but it looks like 2014 could be the year of the robot toy. From remote control cockroaches to smartphone controlled mini drones, no Christmas is going to be complete this year without a robot bursting from the wrapping paper and scaring the bejesus out of your dog. You'll even be able to teach your toddler to code this autumn thanks to two new mini bots from US startup PlayEye, formed by ex-Google and Apple employees. So what the C3PO is going on? To find out, we swivel robotically towards the man behind what might be the breakthrough for connected toys this Christmas, Sphero.
Co-inventor Ian Bernstein is based in Boulder, Colorado in the States, and he met up with our colleague Samuel Gibbs to talk about games and robots.
So the original idea that we had was back at the sort of the end of 2009. I'd been building robots since I was 12 years old. It's pretty much like all I did through high school, actually homeschooled. So I just, you know, built robots and sat on the internet all day until college. And I started a web design company to learn about business, probably around like 2006, and was still working on robots and stuff and sitting there one night using my original iPhone. And I was wondering why I couldn't use this, you know, this cool computer I had in my hand that had GPS and, you know, internet connectivity with 3G and beautiful display. And, you know, I figured everybody would have one of these, and why couldn't I use this thing to control physical objects, specifically like the robots I was working on? And I looked online, like nobody was really doing it. And the people that were doing phone control stuff at that time, it was just a really cumbersome process. So I thought, you know, there was like no way my dad could figure out how to do this stuff. So that was the idea. It was like, well, everybody's going to have a smartphone. I can make it easy for people to control real things with their phone, like, you know, so that even my dad could do it. And through that idea, Adam and I just started like prototyping lots of different stuff. Like we put a remote starter in my car. We like started with an Android phone, and we controlled like a toy tank with a phone and like the garage door. And with all these like little demo videos that we made, we ended up getting into this seed accelerator program in Boulder, Colorado called Techstars. And it was really in Techstars that it's like a 3-month program. And we both like moved to Boulder, and that's just sort of like the intense program that we, you know, had to figure out what exactly we were going to build.
So from that moment, you're in Techstars. Have you got an idea? Have you got the glimmer? Is Sphero a little blinking light in your mind?
When we first got into Techstars, no. I would say like originally going in, our idea was more, we wanted to be more of a platform, create some sort of system that we could then sell to other companies to easily make their products phone controlled. So yeah, when we first got into Techstars, that was our idea. And really, like the first day of Techstars, they're like, no, you can't be a platform. Like, it's going to be so hard. You're going to have to build an end product. And we played around with stuff like, you know, the garage door and more of the obvious things like the home automation and, you know, obvious applications. But we probably, I mean, by the first like week, we probably had 100 different ideas of things that we could have built. And it was like 3 a.m. one night that we were sitting in one of the conference rooms at Techstars, and we're just like racking our head. Like, I was like telling Adam, I was like, we just need something simple, something you could just like keep in your pocket, throw it on the table, and it does something cool. And he was like, well, what about a marble? And when he said that, I thought back to this robot ball I'd actually built when I was probably 13 or 14. And I was like, well, what about a robot ball? And it was just like this crazy idea, but it was all about like gaming. So we were both Adam and I are big gamers, and both of us are, you know, passionately involved in robotics. So that was like the thing that really stuck.
That was your eureka moment.
Yep, exactly.
So from then on, you went on to create Sphero. Can you just describe Sphero for the listeners?
Yeah, so Sphero is a ball. It's like, it's pretty much just solid white. It's made of a high density polycarbonate, so sort of the similar material that you find in like a Nalgene bottle. It's about the size of a baseball, and it glows basically any color you want, with an RGB LED inside. And you connect to this ball, Sphero, over Bluetooth from your like iOS or Android device. And you can actually control which way it moves by using this joystick on the screen. So sort of just the main like play pattern is just driving it like a remote control ball. But what's cool about Sphero is we use all the sensors inside and the LED. We have SDKs, so it's fully programmable in 14 different languages. So we have like tons of different apps and different games you can do. You can play multiplayer games and drive it and play tabletop party games and all different kinds of stuff.
So it's much more than just a ball-shaped remote control car.
Right, exactly. So we're really trying to add depth to the toys that we create. So we're calling these toys connected toys. And when you look at traditional toys, they're just sort of these static things that typically only get played with for one battery cycle. It's sort of the lifetime of traditional toy. But we're really trying to build these toys that have more in-depth, you know, gameplay and more things to do with it. So not only can you download all the games that we've created or third parties have used our SDKs to create, but you can create your own games for Sphero. You can program it either for iOS or Android, or we've gone all the way down to create three different apps for Sphero that you can actually program it right from your phone. We're using it in schools, like middle school kids are using it in their classes to learn about geometry and basic programming techniques, and then the ones that are like really excited about it can then go and actually make like an iOS app if they want to be more advanced.
You're currently on your second generation of Sphero. What changed from the first one?
I mean, when we were first developing this thing, I mean, it's cool because it's just a ball and people, you'd like show somebody and they're like, oh, it's just a ball. And it's kind of frustrating sometimes because on the inside, when you open it up and actually see the robot inside, it's incredibly, incredibly difficult to actually get this thing to work. So basically when we first built the very first Sphero is we weren't sure, well, one, if we could even make it, but we weren't sure sort of what the performance would be. So we did our best, and then as we learned, you know, programming it afterwards, that we're like, okay, we can make this thing faster. But in the original version, like, we didn't have fast enough motors and stuff inside of it. So the version 2 of Sphero, it's over twice as fast. It glows brighter. We put better sensors on our motors, so we can do more fidelity on our driving, so that it's a lot easier to control. Just a bunch of improvements like that.
There must have been quite a lot of programming involved. Looking at it and trying to control one myself, it just reminded me of how difficult to control these kind of like things are, especially if there's no kind of aid to it. There must have been quite a lot of trial and error to get it right.
Yeah, definitely. And we're always improving it, which is cool about these connected toys, again, over like the traditional toys, that the traditional toys, what you buy is kind of what you get. But with Sphero, we're always releasing new firmware updates and new software updates to make the product better.
And how did you come up with the backstory? I see when you first launched the Sphero 2 on the application on the phone, you come away with this... a backstory of of balls being trapped in an alien world.
Yeah. So that was kind of a recent addition on the app side that we released with the new version of Sphero, and we created this whole like story mode. Like you said, there's this whole intro video that we had Brent Spiner. He's a fan of Sphero.
I thought I recognized him.
Yeah, Data from Star Trek. So he did all the voiceovers for it. He's definitely a fan of Sphero, and yeah, it was cool, and like we have all these missions. You can level up the ball, and definitely we found that basically the usage when people play that story mode, the engagement on the level up mode is just it's way, way higher than just driving.
It's gamification.
Yep.
That's one of the things that I think about connected toys. In some of the others I've played with, they are relatively expensive compared to most toys, and it's the fact that you have to bring them back to, you know, like you say, past the first battery drain. Do you see gamification and kind of like the AR aspects as your kind of way to get people coming back time and time again?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I mentioned some of these different play modes where augmented reality is one of them, where you put the ball on the ground and then you use your iPhone and you point your camera of the iPhone at it, and we can track the ball in real time, and then we can overlay different 3D characters on top of the ball. So when you look at your iPhone screen while you're looking at your living room or whatever with the ball on the ground, you don't actually see the ball on the screen of your iPhone. You see this little, like, for instance, we call him Sharky the Beaver. So this little beaver character on top of it, and as you roll the ball, the beaver character just kind of like walks along. So we can do a lot more interaction there. What we're working on now is just sort of making that simpler. So, I mean, it's a little bit tricky right now because you have to, as you're driving the ball, you're also having to like keep your phone pointed at the ball, and the ball is sort of in your video frame. So we're working on different ways to make that easier. And I think that AR technology is like, we can do so many cool things with it. once we perfect it.
That's Sphero 2. So what's next?
So in January this year, we just basically showed some first prototypes of our new product, which is called 2B. So it's actually a tube shape. And we wanted to really focus on customizability of the product, multiplayer. So 2B is crazy fast. Like, this thing goes over 5 meters a second. Huh. So it's just, I mean, it hauls, and like, you hit a little jump and it'll get about a meter of air. So you actually jump this little thing like up onto tables, and when you're in the air, you can do different tricks. Like, you can press this like trick button while like just at the right time as you go off the jump, and you can do like do spins. And this product's actually a little bit cheaper than Sphero, so it's going to be more accessible to, you know, schools and stuff. So it also uses our whole control system, and you'll also like the whole programming languages and the SDKs that are for Sphero will also just right out of the box work for 2B. So it's, you know, programmable, and there'll be lots of apps for it as well.
Who is the Sphero aimed at? I mean, it's £100 in the UK. Is it aimed at the kids, or is it really aimed at big kids with smartphones?
I think both. I think right now I would say when we started, we just kind of tried a lot of different things to see what kind of stuck. And I would say right now we're focusing on more of the younger demographic. But I would say there's definitely a bunch of different demographics that are buying Spheros. Like, you know, obviously the kids love it and they're playing games and stuff. And then there's like pet owners that want it for like their pets, or just like, you know, the tech people. That's just because it's cool and you can program it and they're coding to it and stuff like that. So I would say there's a bunch of different like niches that were there who are our customers.
We've seen from like the car stuff, Apple's recently launched CarPlay, the Geneva Motor Show, and it was one of its primary focus was voice control. Voice control's become a massive part of technology, things like Siri, but also like Microsoft's Cortana and even Google's Google Now. Do you think voice control can kind of come into this sphere?
Yes, and we've actually tried it. One of the first versions of the main Sphero app that we created, that's used just for the basic control of the ball. We did do some voice commands, and we even had this mode called Follow Me, which was pretty cool, where it uses the sensors inside your phone, and essentially you could connect to your Sphero, have it next to you, and then hit this like Follow Me mode, and then just throw the phone in your pocket and walk around, and the ball would follow you. Huh. It didn't work quite well enough, and I think when we did that app, this was probably almost 3 years ago now, I think like the voice recognition and the sensors inside the phone weren't good enough, but we should definitely revisit that. We actually talked about that last week, of sort of bringing back that Follow Me feature, because I know in some of the latest iPhones, Apple was really promoting better sensing data for being able to use your phone as like a fitness tracker. I think sort of those APIs that they've created for that might actually work really well for our Follow Me feature and the voice commands.
So could you see a party game where people are screaming left, right, up, down?
Yes, absolutely.
Many thanks then to Ian Bernstein, and Sphero 2 is out now and the B2 model is out soon. I, for one, welcome our tiny robot overlords. My thanks again then to studio guests Ian Simons and Jonathan Smith, but from me, Keith Stewart and Alex Hearn, and the Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye, humans.